The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
To welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. This hour is set aside to investigate in depth important issues that we believe are not being given a fair airing. We believe that these are all important issues for the public interest. Today, the topic, gas hydrofracking. As many of you in this audience know, there has been a movement in New York State to encourage Governor Cuomo and the New York State Legislature to approve what would amount to upwards of 77,000 of these wells. They have done a very good job of creating a propaganda campaign. They seem to have unlimited resources to lobby on their behalf. We, the people, however, do not have those same resources. So we've relied upon those people who do have background and experience, not just in New York, but around the United States, to deconstruct the arguments. Is gas hydrofracking a legitimate way of providing clean energy? If not, what are the circumstances that we should be aware of? What's being hidden? What have the mainstream media not covered? Joining me in this panel discussion today will be David Braun. David is at this moment in the Capitol offices in Albany, awaiting to testify on behalf of opposition to hydrofracking in New York State. He is helping to coordinate anti-fracking efforts with a rally at Governor Cuomo's Manhattan office, and also he has written extensively on this. Yeah, he is also the campaign director for the Academy Award-nominated documentary Gasland. And he has testified before New York Senate in opposition to gas drilling in the Marcellus shale beds that are being targeted by the oil and gas industries. Then we will have Jennifer Krill. Jennifer has been an activist for environmental advocacy for over 30 years and is the executive director for Earthworks. That's a very respected, decades-old national organization dedicated to protecting the environment from the blows of mineral oil and natural gas extraction and development and their impact on social issues and human rights. Earlier, she was program director for the Rainforest Action Network and a program director for its campaigns to protect old-growth forest from the oil and energy industries. She has also held stints with Greenpeace, Earth Island Institute, and Sea Turtle Restoration Project. Then we have Sharon Wilson. Sharon is considered the leading citizen expert about the Barnett Shale beds. She's become a go-to person in Texas for information on the destruction of environmental impacts and the risks to health caused by hydrofracking for top EPA officials from Washington, D.C. And also, prior to her activism opposing hydrofracking, she worked in the energy industry for 12 years. She has now combined her forces with Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project and is co-author of a Texas report on this flowback, how the Texas natural gas boom affects health and safety. And finally, we have Craig Michaels. He is an attorney and consultant based in New York City, currently working on the hydrofracking issue for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Catskill Mountain Keeper. He previously served as the Watershed Program Director for Riverkeeper and has been involved in this environmental issue in New York since 2009. He is a graduate of University of Michigan School and also with a doctorate in law from Pace Law School. Now, what I thought we would do, they are all on the phone together. We would go through this by issues. First, we have to assume that many people listening, since we're heard worldwide, are not really familiar with gas hydrofracking. They may have heard the term, so we're going to have a more in-depth analysis of what it is, and we're going to begin that by speaking with Sharon Wilson. Nice to have you with us today, Sharon.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sharon, I would like for you to talk about what gas hydrofracking is, and then segue from what it is and the arguments made on behalf of it to the actual toxic and health effects to the environment and water sources given the rampant hydrofracking in Texas. And you can speak also about airborne chemicals from fracking, which we don't hear much about.
Hydraulic fracturing is the gas, shale gas, is in very dense shale formation down deep in the earth. And it's in little pockets in this shale formation. It's not in a pool. So they need to fracture the shale so that the gas bubbles can flow up the drill pipe. So what they do is they drill down vertically, as you would, as they have been doing for decades. But then this new technique, they turn and they drill horizontally through the shale. Then they blast through the drill pipe in the horizontal shale and perforate it. Then they take a lot of, anywhere from 5 million to 13 million in the Eagle Ford Shale. They use about 13 million gallons of water mixed with sand or some other kind of proppant and chemicals, and they pump that under great pressure down the drill pipe so that it goes through those perforations into the shale and fractures it so that the gas can then travel up the drill pipe to the wellhead. And then into a pipeline, they have to have a pipeline. Each gas well has to have a pipeline to it. It's not like crude oil where they would pick it up with a truck in many cases. But they have to have a pipeline that would then take it to other facilities for further processing, maybe a compressor station, a metering station, a gas processing plant. And all of these types of facilities are needed to support the gas wells. And when industry comes in a new area, they do not do a full disclosure and tell you that we have to have all this additional infrastructure to support these wells. So what they're doing here is people have gas processing plants right in their backyard. And all of these, at every stage of development, they have fugitive leaks, just fugitive emissions that are leaking at different stages. And then other times they have planned releases and blowdowns, and then other times they have accidental releases and things that they call acts of God. So the bottom line is the gas is not staying in the pipes. It is going out into the atmosphere and in people's backyards, trespassing into their homes, and they're being exposed to all sorts of chemicals and toxics in the air. The chemical mix that they use to frack with is another problem. There's, you know, it's hard just to sum up all the many issues with this. There's the hydraulic fracturing and the chemicals. They don't disclose. They are starting to disclose some of the chemicals, but they don't disclose all the chemicals. And it creates a massive amount of waste. According to the American Petroleum Institute, each foot you drill down has about 1.2 barrels of solid waste. And then it creates a lot of liquid waste. So there's massive amounts of waste that have to be disposed of. And then there are these emissions that industry cannot seem to get control of the emissions. So those are some of the problems. There's truck traffic and noise and lights and property values that diminish and many, many other problems.
All right, I'm going to ask you, Sharon, and the other speakers, please speak close to the telephone. We're having difficulty hearing you. But I'm going to stay with you for the moment because I want you to address something that could make all the difference in the world as far as the public accepting or rejecting hydrofracking. Do you have any evidence that hydrofracking is related to earthquakes or tremors, including the one that happened in Oklahoma just 2 weeks ago and the one that happened in England in the English countryside earlier this year?
Well, the one in Europe, they did say that it was related to the fracking. The European Geological Society, and I may not be naming it exactly right, but they did say that it was caused from the fracking. There is, of course, industry denies that there is any connection, any proven link between hydrocarbon drilling and seismicity, but there is a report titled Seismicity in the Oil Field by Schlumberger, and Schlumberger is one of the big fracking companies, and it talks about, it does some case studies about fracking and injecting and producing hydrocarbons can cause seismicity. They say that, you know, that they are pointing to the injection wells, but actually in this report it says, in some places, extraction of fluid induces seismicity, and other places, injection induces seismicity. And it says in the report that sometimes it can be, the events can be significant.
All right. Talk about the lax regulations and oversight of the gas industry.
Well, there was just a report today that came out that focuses on how lax the regulation and enforcement is in Texas. It said that 96%, let me quote from that report, it just came out today, in Texas, 96% of the 80,000 violations by oil and gas drillers in 2009 resulted in no enforcement action. So they're not afraid of enforcement. That the fines are very, very small compared to how much that they're earning, and it's not a deterrent. It doesn't seem to be a deterrent. They don't assess fines most of the time, and when they do, the fines are pretty small compared to what the companies are earning. And oftentimes, the operator can negotiate with the regulatory agency and get their fine lowered quite a bit.
My final question may seem to some off the realm of possibility. I'd like for you to tell me if it is or is not, and then address with whatever evidence you may have. You've uncovered, from what I understand, some PSYOPs, the military insurgent manual usage by the gas corporations. Is this true or not true?
Well, they admitted it. I have a tape where they admit using military psychological warfare techniques. And in the military, they call it actually PSYOP without an S on the end. I just learned that today. I've been calling it PSYOPs. But they are using those techniques in our neighborhoods. We've known this for quite a while, but, you know, we just didn't have the confirmation of it. But the more disturbing thing is that they refer to us as insurgents, and it's not just one company that referred to American citizens as insurgents. It was several. And it seems that the oil and gas industry has declared war on the American public.
So would it be within the realm of feasibility to assume, based upon their position and statements, that anyone actively opposed to hydrofracking would be, in their mind, no better than a terrorist or an insurgent?
I believe that somewhere in Pennsylvania, Aubrey McClendon of Chesapeake did refer to people who were opposing gas drilling as terrorists.
I say this simply because, as we now know, if you watch 60 Minutes last evening, Steve Croft talking about the power of politicians to make enormous amounts of money from insider trading that is not illegal because the legislators wrote that it would not be illegal to engage in insider trading on information that they have before their committees in secret testimony, and that if you and I did it, we would go to jail. And also a week before, Leslie Stahl interviewed Jack Abramoff, arguably the most notorious lobbyist in Washington's recent history, who went to jail for stealing tens of millions of dollars from Indian casinos operators. And he said, Jack Abramoff said, that virtually everything done in Washington, everything, is done for the selfish self-interest of corporations using lobbyists as the go-to people to put the money into politicians' pockets, war chest. Now, if you take the two programs together, it would seem that there is a war going on, a war between the American consumer accepting that their government is working on their behalf, but the real battle is defending the interests of the special corporate high rollers who can afford the lobbies, who can afford the ads and campaigns. Now, we also know that the military-industrial complex, which is mammoth, the Washington Post did a story showing that there were 16 agencies that had been kept secret, many of them doing the same identical work. I'm now connecting some dots that if you went against the hydrofracking industry, you're also going against sometimes the dirty energy cartels, and I'm going to ask my next guest that in a moment, like Exxon. These people have former members, current members in this administration, in the intelligence community, in Homeland Security, and they can use those agencies to put people who they deem a threat to their profits on enemies' list. Nixon did it with the Internal Revenue Service. Johnson did it with the Internal Revenue Service. Most presidents, including Kennedy, use the Internal Revenue Service to go against his enemies. Now, I wouldn't say it's the Internal Revenue Service. I would say it's other agencies that could end up putting you on a list that you're not even aware on. And I just add those, my own personal and subjective comments, because if they're acknowledging PSYOPs and military insurgent manual usage, then it changes the nature of how we have to look at hydrofracking and how they're looking at it, because they can say it's a national security issue. And the moment it comes under the security of the nation, anything they wish to do, say, they are virtually indemnified from, and you are a target. Anyhow, your final thought on this issue before we move on.
Well, they are saying that it's a national security issue. They're already saying that, and the irony is that they are applying for permits for LNG permits to ship this overseas to Asia, where they can sell it at a lot more profit than they can in the United States. Here it's about $3.50 per MCF, and over there it would be around $11 to $14 per MCF. So it's worth it to them to ship it over there and sell it at a greater profit, which then would create more demand here. If we could end up being short on energy here. They call it a national security issue, energy independence, and they refer to it that way all the time. But I just wanted to say that the Department of Homeland Security visits my blog fairly regularly, and so does the Navy Intel Division. So I don't know. Maybe that means I'm on a list.
Oh, you're on a list, so they wouldn't be visiting you. The question is, what will they do because you're on a list? You could be deemed as dangerous to the national security as many of the environmental activists were, who tried to stop some of the clear-cutting and other things and were deemed a menace to society. Thank you for your input. Stay tuned. Let's now go say hello to David Braun. David, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Gary. Nice to have you. Thanks
Good.
To be
I'm
here.
Ask
Thank you.
Just to talk up loud, please. David,
yes, sir.
Talk about Bob Howard at Cornell University, a study. Also, please speak about how life cycle of hydrofracking is far more dirty than even coal over a 20-year period, and then wrap it up with a discussion on the toxicity of water resources that Sharon alluded to that you're familiar with also.
Sure, absolutely. If I can just weigh in on some of the previous conversation about, you know, the terrorism. I think it's very interesting that the industry is treating people who are just basically trying to protect our most precious natural resource, which is water and clean water that wars are fought over in other places, from actually being damaged and poisoned, that the folks that are actually fighting for clean water are and trying to defend honest, good Americans and this precious natural resource are getting labeled as terrorists, whereas the companies that are actually poisoning the water are basically being allowed to do this on a very massive scale, with very little protection for the people who actually have this injustice done onto them, and, you know, very little recourse. And these companies are able to do this and do it legally. I mean, if I was to go in and dump a jar of frac fluid into the New York City, our reservoirs, I would be arrested. Meanwhile, these companies are getting away with poisoning people's water, and the folks in Dimmock are a very good example, Dimmock, Pennsylvania, where their water has been poisoned, and they at first were the company Cabot Oil and Gas was required to actually replace their water, and now they have been given a reprieve, and the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has agreed to go along with this, where these families whose water is still not safe to drink are no longer receiving water shipments. So this company has basically poisoned these folks' water, was at first required to replace their water, and now is not, and these folks are left on their own. Now, I don't know the proper definition of terrorism, but I would say that those people probably aren't feeling very safe or secure in their homes. And I think it's just very interesting, the kind of level of projection that goes on from an industry that's doing this. In regards to the Bob Howard study, it's an interesting study in that, you know, the gas industry is claiming that natural gas is a cleaner burning fuel. And if you look at natural gas and just say that the combustion and consider the combustion of it, that they are right that it is a cleaner burning fuel, but they are expecting that in the next few years that 90% of all the natural gas that we receive will actually come from hydraulic fracturing. And the funny thing is that when you take into consideration the full life cycle of hydraulic fracturing, meaning all of the 1,200 or so roughly truck trips and the particulate matter and the CO2 that those trucks emit, and taking the water and the chemicals and the sand to each well pad, and that's for each well, 1,200 truck trips per well. And you take into consideration the methane seepage, which I think is something like 3 to 6%, which is they felt was a fairly Bob Howarth and this the other folks at Cornell University felt that was a fairly conservative estimate. And then you take into consideration the combustion. When you take into consideration all of those things, what they found is that over a 20-year period, the natural gas is actually 20% dirtier than coal. In over a 100-year period, it's actually on par with coal. So the natural gas industry is, and the oil and gas industry is really what it is trying to convince the United States that this is a kind of a safe, clean energy for us, that the hydraulic fracturing is an acceptable thing. But in reality, they're replacing it with something that's on par with coal. And there's a massive build-out going on across the country right now with, you know, $700 billion build-out of pipelines, power plants, 150 power plants, mostly across the South. But, you know, here in New York, we've got one going in Astoria, Queens. And it's all a part of this natural gas build-out to get us kind of hooked on this new form of energy, which is natural gas. And if I may, I think it's critical to mention that there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that came out last February, and it talked about how Exxon is running out of its oil reserves, that they are dwindling. And because of this, they purchased a company called XTO, which is a big drilling company, and that they are basically retooling their product line because they're running out of oil and they need to keep making big profits moving into the future. And so what we're seeing is that it's not just an isolated incident with Exxon, that Chevron bought a company called Atlas, and BP has gotten in the business, and Shell is in the business as well, and ConocoPhillips. And so there's all these big oil companies that are now setting their sights on drilling for natural gas using hydraulic fracturing. And so what they want to do is they essentially want to, with all these pipelines and with all these power plants and this whole build-out, is shackle us to this process of hydraulic fracture, which is an incredibly toxic, damaging, dangerous process. And it's a frightening prospect, especially in light of that the policy is essentially being written by the oil and gas companies, that they're being allowed to do this. And, you know, the State Department's going ahead and, you know, in foreign countries and is promoting natural gas development via hydraulic fracturing. And so, you know, essentially they're demonstrating that they're on board with this build-out. And it's extremely disconcerting, especially when we have companies like General Electric who've been developing renewable energy and they've been working on forms of solar energy. And General Electric is now telling us that solar energy in the next 5 years will be cheaper than any energy created by fossil fuels. So if we know that solar energy in 5 years, which is a very short period of time, is going to be cheaper than fossil fuels, then, you know, the only sensible decision in terms of a policy decision would be actually to move toward solar energy and start to build out a grid and invest in this renewable energy, because that is the energy of the future. It is not an energy of an industry that is dying like the dinosaurs that they drill, and trying to just reemerge in another form. It's an energy that will actually take us into the future and will not be toxic for us and warming and climate change crisis. And it will actually be a better thing for the health and well-being of many of the citizens.
David, I appreciate those thoughts. Please hold your additional thoughts until we come back. We're going to go over now and say hello to Jennifer Krill, K-R-I-L-L. Nice to have you with us, Jennifer.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. I'm just going to ask you to please speak up. Jennifer, there's a great deal of information that we now have from global research that the engineers knew Fukushima was unsafe but covered it up. And now we see the extreme vulnerability of new U.S. plants is being covered up. And even though this may seem as if it's not associated, I believe it absolutely is, because we're dealing with the same industries. I'm going to quote this from the Washington blog. It says, "The current nuclear reactor design was chosen not because it was safe, but because it worked on Navy submarines, and governments have been covering up nuclear meltdowns for 50 years. BBC reporter Greg Pallast reports, based on a first-hand interview of a senior engineer for the corporation which built the Fukushima nuclear plants and a review of the engineer's field diaries, that the engineers who built the Fukushima nuclear plants knew their designs would fail in an earthquake. Quote, the plant was riddled with problems that no way on earth could stand an earthquake. The team of engineers sent in to inspect found that most of these components could, quote, completely and utterly fail during an earthquake. That is a quote, and it's about Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant in New York State, not about Fukushima. But the company fraudulently changed the seismic report to pretend the plant was earthquake safe, and the exact same thing was done at Fukushima. Now, of all the places in the world where no one in their right mind would build scores of nuclear power plants, Japan would be at the top of the list. And Japan sits on four tectonic plates at the edge of the subduction zone and is in one of the most tectonically active regions of the world. And many of those reactors have been negligently sited on active faults, particularly in the subduction zone along the Pacific coast, where major earthquakes of magnitude 7 to 8 or more on the Richter scale occur frequently. And so that is a concern. So we have people who are only interested in saving money and making money, not in protection. And that, unfortunately, is the case of Fukushima, and we see the results. Now, I'm not going to ask you to address that directly. That's going to be for our final panelist coming on, Craig Michaels, because he's in New York, and no one thought that Indian Point would be at risk of an earthquake. And lo and behold, we had a 5.8 earthquake just a couple months ago. And what about, and then I'm going to ask him about, can anything happen to a hydraulic fracked well, especially if you have 77,000 of them in New York State, if there is an earthquake around any of those wells? What is the downside? Or could they actually exacerbate or cause an earthquake? That'll be for him. But for you, what we're finding is that there is a connection between the oil or gas companies, sometimes one and the same, working together with lobbyists to push through the natural gas cars, natural gas everything. And I want you to take us on a journey now, showing us the involvement of organizations and who gets the money, the hydrofracking monies to legislators, and even Obama's super committee, because that is a part of this whole problem. The forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Gary. It is an interesting story in terms of energy money in politics to show that you get what you pay for. In the last congressional campaign, the current members of Congress took over $25 million in campaign contributions from the oil, gas, and coal industries. In the House, Speaker Boehner has received the most campaign contributions. In the Senate, there are 10 senators that have taken over $4 million apiece in the lead-up to the last elections. And the list goes on and on. I would direct listeners to an amazing resource to follow the dirty energy money, and that is a website called dirtyenergymoney.com. And you can go there, and you can plug in your zip code. You can plug in a member of Congress or the Senate, and you can plug in any company, and you can find out where they're where they've made campaign contributions, or if it's a member of Congress you're looking for, you can find out what campaign contributions they've received. Since 1999, there are 10 energy companies that have donated more than $38 million to congressional and Senate election campaigns. And one of the things that we noted in 2005, when the Bush-Cheney Energy Policy Act was passed, it included a small but significant provision exempting oil and gas drilling from the Safe Drinking Water Act. This is from the Energy Policy Act of 2005. as a result, some of the impacts that that Sharon and David just discussed, the impacts on drinking water and the concerns that people have when hydraulic fracturing occurs, when oil and gas drilling occurs, these impacts are exempt from our federal laws. The oil and gas industry also enjoys exemptions from the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, exemptions from our Superfund law, from National Environmental Policy Act, from having to accrue their full toxic release inventory. The net result is, because the oil and gas industry has acquired such political influence over over our politicians, the folks that are supposed to be governing, the folks that govern this country and that are supposed to be protecting our environmental rights and be the stewards of how we manage industries in this country. Instead, the oil and gas industry is exempt from our most important environmental laws. And we believe if we're going to correct any of these problems with hydraulic fracturing and with the impacts of oil and gas drilling, we need to close these loopholes and get dirty energy money out of our government.
What is your greatest concern or concerns about gas hydrofracking that the public is not aware of and the media has chosen not to cover?
You know, there's a lot of coverage now on water impacts, and there has is increasing scientific information on air impacts and the greenhouse gas issues. But your question is an interesting one, Gary. What has not yet been covered? I think what has not yet been fully explained to the public is that at the end of the day, with all of these exemptions from our federal laws, the U.S. taxpayer is going to be on the hook for paying for these impacts. When there's a gas well 150 feet from people's homes and people start to get sick, who's going to pay for the health costs? Who's going to pay for the eventual cleanup? Who's going to pay for the climate change emissions? All of that represents, as yet, an uncalculated subsidy to the oil and gas industry.
I appreciate those insights. Let's go over now and say hello to our final panelist who's waiting here to share his insights on this, Craig Michaels. Craig, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gary.
Craig, let's take a look point for point at New York State. Mm-hmm. And the governor being supportive of gas hydrofracking. Take a look at the shortcomings and deficiencies in the New York plans for fracking, the Marcellus Shell bed, what it means to people, and especially what is the story not being told by the media concerning what it could do to our drinking water environment in New York State.
Okay, well, you know, New York State, I mean, I'll start off with the good news, which is of course very limited these days. New York State, to its credit, is the only state that I know of that has actually decided to take a look at the environmental impacts of high-volume hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling before permitting it. So, you know, it deserves credit for that. The problem is, you know, it's been doing this environmental review for, I guess, roughly 3 years, and it's now come out, New York State has now come out with a revised environmental impact statement. And unfortunately, despite, you know, being 1,500 pages long and despite regulations that are an additional 500 pages, it's still completely inadequate and deficient in several respects. And I think the one interesting thing when you look at New York is that Once you dig deeper, pun intended, into the possible issues with hydrofracking, you see just all of the problems and really all of the unanswered questions here, and that we're sort of flying blind here on this state-by-state approach. And like Jennifer pointed out, these companies are exempt from all federal laws, so it really it's up to the states to do their part. We authored, I co-authored a report about a year ago called Fractured Communities, which documented hundreds of cases around the country where state and federal regulators identified hydrofracking as either the known or suspected cause of contamination to air, contamination to groundwater, drinking water, surface water, etc. And I think that what we see here is that the industry is clearly playing up the economic aspect of this, that being jobs, and trying to sort of pull the wool over everyone's eyes with respect to the environmental problems. So if you look at New York State, you know, one of the issues here is that wastewater. I mean, that's one of the biggest issues that I think that you know, I think people are talking about these days. The DEC Commissioner Joe Martens stated publicly that there are no wastewater treatment plants in New York equipped to treat or permitted to accept wastewater with the range of contaminants expected to be in fluids produced from fracking. Now, that's a direct quote. However, you know, in the environmental impact statement, they publish a list of all the public treatment plants in New York, as if that list is supposed to have some sort of meaning. None of these plants are equipped to treat this wastewater, and this is something that we're either going to be punting to other states, we're either going to be, you know, shipping it to Ohio and doing deep well injection there, or we're going to have private wastewater industrial treatment plants built. And of course, the New York State has absolutely no analysis of that in its 1,500-page document. We don't know where these plants will be. We don't know what the impacts will be of them. We don't know what types of pollutants they're going to be discharging into what waterways. So I think at the end of the day, and really, I mean, we could spend hours here talking about the flaws in New York State's plan. At the end of the day, we have just a boatload of unanswered questions. Where's the wastewater, you know, going to go? What are the cumulative impacts when you're talking about impacts from everything from deforestation to road building to the types of chemicals that might pop up in private water wells or in public drinking water supplies? And what is it going to take the state to adequately regulate this? I mean, that's something I think, you know, has been covered, you know, well by the New York Times is Ian Urbina's series on drilling down. I think that's one of the issues that is really kind of lurking in the background, but it's going to come to the forefront, and that is, are the states really equipped to properly permit and monitor and inspect and enforce regulations with regards to hydrofracking? And I think we've seen across the board the answer is no. They're simply not. And again, you know, I think the main thing that we've done in this country as a whole is, which I think is problematic with respect to natural gas drilling and to other forms of energy production, is we've taken the precautionary principle, right, the globally recognized scientific principle that says, in the face of uncertainty, in the face of risk, you err on the side of caution. We've taken that principle and we've thrown it out the window. And instead, we're proceeding with this drill first, ask questions later mentality, and that should be unacceptable from a scientific standpoint. It should be unacceptable to workers who might be exposed to chemicals. It should be unacceptable to landowners who may wind up, as David pointed out, like landowners in Dimmick who may wind up without safe drinking water. And I think, you know, one of the things Jennifer pointed this out as well is we're looking at all the potential benefits that might come from this. Okay, we're going to have fuel for X amount of years. We're going to have possibly a cleaner burning fuel, whether or not we even agree with these benefits. But we're not looking at all at the costs. And Jennifer and Sharon said this before, what are the taxpayers going to have to do to repair the roads that are destroyed? What are the costs going to be to you know, publicly owned treatment plants that are, you know, ill-equipped to treat this waste? And what are going to be the socioeconomic costs? What are counties and states going to lose in terms of recreational opportunities, tourism opportunities? You know, I mean, we're sort of turning a blind eye to all the businesses, especially in places in upstate New York, that depend on people coming there year-round to go fishing and hiking and camping, and all sorts of other recreational opportunities. So not sure if that answers your question, but that's, I guess, a good place to start.
Yes, it does, a lot of it. Now, a few more specific questions, if you would, please. Let's take a look at some specific instances of what has occurred on people's land. How much were they given? What is the inducement? Why would someone virtually despoil a beautiful piece of property upstate, especially where you're at higher elevations, 1,500 to 2,500 feet in the Catskills over to the Adirondacks? You're looking at some beautiful scenery, not when you have a gas hydrofracking well in your backyard. What's it done to their water, their air, the value of their land? What were they paid? And so we have some real faces and real stories behind the other side of this picture.
Well, my understanding is that, you know, and again, I've been very focused on the Northeast. My understanding is that when these companies first came to Pennsylvania, which I might be wrong, but I think was probably somewhere around 2003 to 2005, they were giving people about $25 an acre. And I'm not sure exactly what the royalties were, but obviously they were you know, completely lowballing landowners. And the landmen, again, is from what I know, you know, have a specific strategy, which is they tell the people that it's now or never, everyone else is doing it, and just sign here, and you're not even going to know that we were on your land. And, you know, times are tough. I think that's something that landowners, average Americans, you know, they might not consider themselves environmentalists. They might not consider themselves gas industry people. They're just thinking, well, you know, this gives me a chance to do my part get some energy, and I'll get a little something in the bank, and, you know, why not? It sounds good. And unfortunately, they found that this comes with a big cost. Again, going back to Dimock, Pennsylvania, I mean, everything that could go wrong with fracking went wrong in Dimock. And it went wrong because the regulators weren't there to monitor and enforce. They weren't regulations adequate to begin with, and companies cut corners at every possible turn in order to maximize their profits. Now, in upstate New York, right now, and in the past few years, landowners have gotten together and they've collectively bargained for higher prices. So there are people that are getting $6,000 an acre and upwards of 18% royalty for any gas that's found there. Now, that obviously is a big incentive. And of course, as a New York City resident, you know, when we go upstate and we tell folks that, you know, they should be careful, they, you know, the kind of the sentiment that we get back is, well, you know, who are the downstaters supposed to tell us what to do with our land? You know, we need jobs up here. We need this economic opportunity. And I think that's a valid point. The problem is when you talk about horizontal drilling, this isn't just something that affects one landowner. This can affect entire communities. When you're talking about, you know, the truck traffic that has to go down these mountain roads just to truck the water in to the wells, the fresh water, which again we don't know where it's coming from, but it's obviously coming from a lake or stream or reservoir, and then the trucks that have to go out again and take the fracking wastewater out again. We don't know where they're taking it, but they have to do that. When you look at those costs, it's bigger than just an individual landowner. It's something that's going to affect entire towns and counties and states. And what we're seeing now in New York is that towns are trying their best to do what they can on the local level to prohibit heavy industrial activities like this. And now we find the industry in the position where it's always been, which is, we don't need the feds to tell us what to do. The states are doing it great, and we're certainly not going to let the local towns tell us where we can and can't drill. So, you know, we'll just keep it at the state level, and everything's going to be fine. And, of course, you know, that's really not the case. And so we're working hard to try to empower communities with the tools that they need to properly regulate this and enforce this and restrict this in a way that they think is right. I mean, you have the industry saying, oh, well, the federal government can't tell us where and when to drill because they're not on the ground. They don't know the local conditions. But then when a local municipality says, we don't want you guys here, they say, well, you can't tell us what to do. And it's just, it's one of those situations. I mean, that's something I think that maybe could be reported on a little bit more.
All right. Sharon Wilson, back to you on this. Sharon, Texas is one of the most severely affected drought states in America. 70% of the state is now in permanent drought. Tens of thousands of animals lost. In fact, I have some inside information that at least two of the cities in Texas over the next 10 years will simply have to depopulate itself and remove people to other areas because there will not be adequate water for the citizens, for farming, for industry. For all the different needs, the aquifers are drying up. And in Austin, for example, as one example, they can only water once a week. So as a friend of mine who lives in Austin said, you see nothing but brown lawns. That said, when you take into account how much water is required for gas hydrofracking and already a water-challenged state, doesn't that make some sense that people should think about how they are going to sustain gas hydrofracking when they don't even have water to sustain agriculture or livestock or people's homes?
I only get to water twice a month. So, well, I think it does make good sense. And the untold story about the water usage is that the only numbers that we have come straight from industry. They're voluntarily given from industry. Nobody goes out and meters it. In Wise County, where I used to live, they have a groundwater conservation district, so they are trying to start metering how much water industry uses. And in 2009, they used over 1 billion gallons of water just in that small water conservation district. But the other part of that is they also stole water from unmetered sources. They weren't supposed to. They were only supposed to take water from the metered sources. But they got it from many different sources. This was obtained through an open records request, and they did not get any enforcement action for stealing this water. So they have really no incentive to follow the law. But the important story that a lot of people don't understand is that this water is permanently removed from our active hydrologic cycle. It will not be available for future generations to use, for agricultural use. They inject it into these deep injection wells where it is essentially removed from our active hydrologic cycle. So that's the most alarming thing, part of it. And they are experimenting with water recycling. It's just a token amount at this point, and I'm not really clear on how well they can do that, how often they're doing it. I do know that it creates a lot of emissions when they recycle it, and there are some waste products from that. So,
I'm very concerned for several reasons. We're coming up to the end of our program, but a few closing thoughts I want to share with. One, we now know that there is gross water shortages and droughts in New York State, in Texas, in Pennsylvania. We also know that in a friend of mine who lives in Wyoming, where they're doing a lot of hydrofracking, say that the air pollution there is simply unacceptable, something they've never had a problem with in the past. He lives in Cheyenne. We also know that the industries are powerful and they can, along with ALEC, they can influence the state legislative process, and with the federal lobbyists, they can influence the big players in Washington. So it's all against the American public. If any of these major hydrofrack wells should come across a publicly used aquifer, and if there should be a leak from that hydrofrack well into the public aquifer, there is currently no method that they can extract safely over 200 different toxic chemicals, A, because they haven't told what all the chemicals are, and B, because some of these, including mercury, simply wouldn't be removable. That means an entire public's water supply could be permanently adversely affected and polluted. And they can't say that's not possible because some of the hydrofracking already in Pennsylvania has been shown to have gone far afield from the original hydrofracking site, as much as 150 miles. Now, if you do the simple math of 77,000 wells in New York State, and let's just say 100 miles around each one, there's virtually no square footage left in New York State that you could consider safe because of the potential for unintended consequent polluting. So I believe that the American public should be made aware of this. And in closing, Sharon's blog, Sharon Wilson's blog, is texassharon.com. Her website is earthaction.org. Jennifer Kryl's is earthworksaction.org. Over to David Braun. David Braun's is unitedforaction.org. And I don't know if I have yours. Could you give us yours, Craig Michaels? Is it nrdc.org?
Yeah, nrdc.org or CatskillMountainKeeper.org. And again, I just if I could in 10 seconds, just for any listeners that are in New York State or in the Delaware River Basin, we've got a series of hearings coming up that if you go to CatskillMountainKeeper.org, you can get the list of where and when these are going on, but there are chances for people to make their views heard in this region.
Good. And we are putting together every single article that we can find that is a quality article on gas hydrofracking on progressiveradionetwork.org and all the websites and all the call to action groups and legislative action groups, so you can get what you need. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. David Braun and Jennifer Kryl, thank you. Sharon Wilson, we appreciate you being on board. And also Greg Michaels, thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll, and as we do each Monday, we take on the issues in depth. Last week, it was taking an in-depth look at the dangers and the deceptions behind genetic engineered food. Today, it's gas hydrofracking. Next week, well, we'll see. We have a major panel, and we have some upcoming programs on the false war on drugs. We have a lot to share with you. I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Radio Network. Now, Curtis Ellis, Executive Director of American Jobs Alliance, is going to be giving his program. And if Curtis is there, we'll say hello to him. If not, then we will take a short break and come back. He's not in studio. By the way, in a stunning statement revealing twisted priorities or of epic naivety, President Obama encouraged CEOs of some of the biggest outsourcing companies to invest in China, telling them, quote, we should be rooting for China to grow. Hello? Shouldn't we be rooting for America to grow? Nothing like the Democrats having it ass backwards on this one. Have a good evening.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to. 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's the song I love the best.